Hello and welcome to Behind the Buyouts, the deals podcast where we speak to private equity and venture capital practitioners about their deals and deal making. I'm your guest host, Nikita Satyaraju, senior reporter at The Deal. We have with us today Dave Tai, head of North American private equity at Investcorp. Dave initially joined the firm in 1999 before leaving for a four-year stint at CVC Capital Partners in 2011. He rejoined Investcorp in his current role in 2015 and sits on the boards of several of the firm's investments, including Road Safe Traffic Systems and Sunrise Produce. He's here to talk to us about Investcorp's strategy, its current investments, and the M&A landscape in 2023. Dave, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Nitika. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So let's start with talking about your career and how you got your start at Investcorp.
Sure. Like originally, joined Investcorp in early 99 after graduating business school and spending about 5 years at DLJ, which for some of your more mature listeners will remember was a great boutique investment bank in the 80s and 90s. I also spent a couple years as CFO of one of the businesses we owned when I was at Investcorp in my first stint called Jostens, which we actually sold to DLJ. So I left Investcorp in 03 and was CFO for a couple years. We wound up selling half the business to KKR. And then I came back to Investcorp. And then, as you mentioned, I spent several years at CVC Capital Partners as well.
And how did the transition back to Investcorp happen from CVC Capital?
A little bit of conflict, kind of like most things in my career, like the CFO job and like going to CVC and coming back, a little bit of confluence of circumstances. Investcorp's a great firm, CVC's a great firm. And I had an opportunity to come back and to help reshape the business a bit, and we're focused in the middle market. CVC is a mega cap firm. So while there's a lot of similarities in terms of some of the strategic things from an investment standpoint, I think we're focused on typically smaller businesses, typically founder owned in a different stage of their evolution, where we think our ability to accelerate the value creation plan and the growth trajectory is maybe more meaningful for smaller firms than for some larger firms.
Absolutely. And that was really going to be my next question about Investcorp's investment strategy, the sectors that you focus on. And again, you mentioned smaller businesses. So would they be more family or founder owned? I'd love to know a little bit about sort of the checklist that you go through when you're looking at investments.
Sure. You know, across the firm, we globally invest in three primary asset classes: private equity, real estate or real assets, and credit. And within private equity in the US or North America, we're a middle market investor in business services companies with a growth orientation. So we focus on six clearly defined verticals. But if you think kind of at a higher level, think business services, white collar and blue collar, providing what we like to think about in general, more needs versus wants, essential services that people or companies are going to need, we think, through most economic cycles, and that benefit from some long-term secular tailwinds. And those big tailwinds will be things like demographics, technology, the war for talent, outsourcing, et cetera. And yes, almost all of the investments that we make have continued involvement from a founder, family owners, sometimes first generation, sometimes second, third generation. But that's also one of the reasons I think our asset class is so attractive, that when you look at the demographics in the US, the baby boomers are late 50s to early to mid 70s. There's a tremendous amount of wealth held in privately held businesses that has already started. This has been going on for, you know, a decade or so, but it will continue for the next 20 years, where those owners of private businesses are going to figure out their succession. And in many cases, they will bring in private capital partners. And we think we're a particularly attractive alternative for the right sector, for the right business, and then ultimately the right partner.
Yeah, that's the big question everyone asks now. What's your succession plan? After the investment, your value creation that you mentioned earlier, if you could talk a little bit about what that looks like. I imagine it's a mix of both M&A and organic investments. If there are any common themes around that across your portfolio investments, I'd love to know a little bit about that.
Yep, really important question for what we try to do. And the quick answer is yes, there are absolutely common themes. And it's interesting, as I said, we invest in several sectors. So we may have a professional services firm like Cross Country that's providing very sophisticated advice to the office of the CFO around technical accounting advisory, business transformation, financial reporting, cyber and risk management, et cetera, on the one hand. And you mentioned a Sunrise Produce, which has its own complications in its business, but it is a wholesale distributor of fresh produce and related products to a variety of end markets, healthcare, education, food service, et cetera. So very different businesses at the surface. But some of the common themes that we see in terms of working with the CEO and their team on the value creation plan include, as you said, how are we going to grow? How are we going to take market share? What are those plans? And oftentimes we'll see opportunity in the go-to-market strategy. There may be opportunity in pricing. And how do we segment our customers, for example? Almost always technology. You know, the whole world is obviously migrating from analog to digital. And it's true for middle market companies, just like it is for large companies. And most middle market companies are in the early stage of that journey. So providing both the financial capital as well as human capital to help on that is pretty important. The other area that I would say is a common theme is HR. And again, we're all business services. I believe it's true in every business regardless, but it's certainly true when you're in the services business where what you're providing obviously is a service that provisioned by a human being or a set of human beings. And so thinking strategically about human capital, the whole value chain from identifying, recruiting, onboarding, training, developing, providing career path, et cetera. Founder-led companies often haven't leveraged that need as much as they can in terms of having a real senior chief human resources officer at the executive table. So those are a few of the common themes that we see across most businesses.
Absolutely. And I think I want to talk a little bit about the current portfolio investments. You already mentioned Sunrise. I think the one that I wanted to start with was Shearer Supply. It's your second investment, HVAC after Wrench. And I'm just wondering what the thinking behind that was to go from the distribution side this time around.
Sure. Another good question. And you're right. It's a good example, too, of how we think about continuing to leverage our deepening expertise in our verticals. And so you're right. Wrench was a really successful investment for us in the HVAC contracting or dealer business that we invested in 2016. The company did extremely well, continues to do very well. And we've seen an opportunity on the distribution side, you know, the people that are supplying the wrenches with their equipment, their parts and supplies, et cetera. It's got some of the same characteristics as the dealer market in terms of being large. It's fragmented. You know, we're largely dealing with end markets that are less cyclical. Again, think about needs versus wants. Shearer is headquartered in Dallas, Texas. It operates largely in that part of the country. It's hot, obviously. And if your HVAC goes down, it's really not an option if you're going to get it fixed. Now, whether you need a new unit or you just need a repair, of course, the dealer is going to help you make that decision. But it's a really stable end market with, we think, some pretty compelling secular tailwinds for growth. And the distribution market is quite fragmented. So we leveraged a lot of what we learned in Wrench and continued to get smarter about the broader HVAC ecosystem and identified Shearer as something that we thought could be particularly attractive. It also happens to be run by the second and third generation on the founding family, which is, you know, again, something that we do often and something that we like. And I think our support financially resonates with family and founder-led businesses. And I would also mention the CEO of Wrench is also on the board of Shearer. So we continue to leverage, and that's pretty typical as well, where we have a really strong group of advisory directors and independent board members and to be part of the teams on the companies that we invest in, be part of the value creation plan.
Absolutely. And is Shearer's sort of expansion strategy, has that been organically focused or has there been a little bit of M&A? And maybe what you're thinking about is it geographic expansion or from a size perspective, if there's anything that you can share over there?
And the answer to your question is yes and yes. The business had done one acquisition of size before we invested. So they had just started down that path. And we do think there is both a really strong organic growth opportunity, both in their existing markets as well as greenfield markets, but also a really compelling M&A opportunity as well. So we think both of those levers are really important to the growth strategy, as are adding to the complement of the products we provide. And as you, again, you think about if you're selling to a dealer and you're selling that dealer the HVAC equipment, the OE equipment itself, well, there's a whole host of ancillary parts and related services that go with that. And we think that's another area for us of opportunity. And as I said, one thing in general, I would say it's true for all of our investments. We have to have conviction in multiple ways to grow because we know our models are wrong. You know, we spend a ton of time building these very detailed models and going out 10 years and by location or product and service, et cetera. But the reality is business is dynamic. Markets are dynamic. Unexpected events like COVID happen. And so the way we think about it is a range of outcomes. And are we investing in a sector and ultimately a company and a management team that we believe have more upside opportunities than downside risks? Because we know not everything will go exact as we plan. And Shear very much fits that criteria of there's a lot of levers for growth that they can deploy and they can execute on. And frankly, one of the biggest challenges is prioritizing. Because there's in a world of finite resources, both financial and human, we've really got to be thoughtful about where do we place our bets and where do we spend our time and capital to achieve that growth.
Absolutely. The other really interesting company in your portfolio is RoadSafe. For me, I think the traffic control and road safety sector in general has gotten a pretty big boost from the Infrastructure Act, sort of the focus on aging infrastructure. And RoadSafe is typically, in my conversations, comes up as one of the bigger platforms in the sector. So I would love to know a little bit more about that platform, how the investment came about.
Sure. A quick background on the investment is in every one of our verticals, we have dedicated team members working on those verticals. And one of the things in each vertical, we have a pipeline or a shadow portfolio. You know, we'll do work on which subsectors do we think are interesting and build an investment thesis around that. And then ultimately identify companies that we think would be interesting. And Amit Gain, my partner who runs our industrial services vertical, we had identified RoadSafe, I think 3 years before we actually made the investment and spent a lot of time getting to know the business, getting to know the CEO. They had an outside investor, so we got to know the outside investor as well. So when they actually wanted to bring in a new partner, we were, and we felt like we were, you know, in a very differentiated position. We had the support of the CEO. He wanted us to be his partner. There's some parallels to a RoadSafe like there is to a Wrench or some of our other or a Shearer in terms of distributed businesses and what do you do centrally versus what's done in the field, et cetera. And so RoadSafe was part of a subsector thesis around the underinvestment in infrastructure that we all know about, both real infrastructure as well as energy, that we thought would be really compelling. And the market itself that fits a number of our criteria. It's large. It's very fragmented. It's quite stable. We didn't count on the infrastructure bill. We didn't know if it would happen or not. So we underwrote it, assuming more current course and speed and no infrastructure bill. And so in that business, like in Ashear, we believe there are a lot of growth opportunities, both organically and inorganically, with some tailwinds, as you said, from some of the regulation.
Absolutely. It's one of the things that has been coming up more often, traffic control and road safety. Definitely great space to be looking at. And I know we touched upon this already. You talked about Sunrise. There's also Fortune International, which again, seafood and then Sunrise with its fresh foods. I think that's a great illustration of the needs versus wants aspect of investment. Fortune International has been in your portfolio for a couple of years now, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. I would love to know how the company has grown over the past few years. Maybe if there's what's next for the business, more add-ons, more organic growth, some of that as well.
Sure. And you're right. We invested in Fortune in 2020, actually about 2 months before COVID. And Fortune is a wholesale provider of fresh seafood, but also frozen seafood and some high-end premium meat products as well as gourmet products. But it's really a seafood business at heart, and that's still the majority of the business. And the majority of the customer base is food service. We also have a big retail business, but food service, high-end white tablecloth restaurants predominantly is the bulk of the customer base. So obviously, shortly after COVID hit, a big percentage of our customers were shut. You know, one of the other things we do from an investment standpoint is we do not use maximum debt. We are leveraged buyout investors. We're private equity, so we do deploy debt. but we use less than what kind of the market levels will be. And that's really driven by, A, we're trying to create an asymmetric risk return profile for our investor. B, we're investing in businesses for growth. So we think we can create the return more through growth than through just pure financial engineering. And C, as I mentioned a couple of times, a lot of our investments are with family or founder-led businesses, and oftentimes the first-time institutional capital of size. So the companies haven't typically had a lot of debt. And Fortune very much fit that bill. So thankfully, we had not put very much debt on the business. So we were fine when COVID hit. You know, we kept all the people busy. It was an essential service because it was food. We were servicing the retail business. And as soon as takeout and delivery were allowed, we were obviously doing that. And the business has done extremely well since we invested. It's more than tripled in size and revenue. It's now north of $1 billion. That's both organic and M&A. We've completed a number of acquisitions that has expanded our geographic footprint. It's a Chicago headquartered company with a really strong presence in the Chicago market. And we've really expanded that more across both the Midwest, upper and lower, as well as the Gulf states, Texas, Louisiana, et cetera. And we've expanded a bit into the East as well with two significant acquisitions in the last couple of years, D'Artagnan in New Jersey, which is a high-end premium meat and gourmet product business. And then most recently, Boston Sword and Tuna in Boston. And that business, you know, again, as you said, it's a need, not a want. Seafood is still an underpenetrated protein. There is a health and wellness and a demographic angle. Both younger people are obviously more healthy than previously. And as the population ages, they tend to be a little bit more focused on healthy eating, which we can help in that endeavor. And it's obviously stable, relatively stable end markets, we think, with some nice secular tailwind and a lot of growth in front of us.
And so do you anticipate making more acquisitions over there? Do you have a pipeline that you're looking at already?
Yes.
The short answer is yes.
It's still a very fragmented market. And when you think about that business, they're sourcing from something on the order of 70 countries around the world. So it's a complex and complicated supply chain. You can have very small competitors in markets who have a very niche capability, which can be great. But to do it at scale is really hard. And to be able to do it for food service, where a chef comes off at the end of the night at 11 or 12 o'clock, and he or she's got to order their product for the next day. Now, you can't get that from a big broadline distributor. You need somebody like a Fortune, of which we think we're the best super regional there is in the market. But the ability to procure great product and provide great service to that highly demanding customer base is a huge, huge differentiator for us.
The last one that I wanted to talk about is SNS truck parts. Auto aftermarket is another space that I've been looking into and has been relatively busy. What about that category was particularly interesting to you?
So now, also a Chicago-based company in the suburbs. It has nothing to do with the fact that I grew up in Illinois, that we own several businesses, Road Safe, Fortune, and SNS, that all happen to be headquartered in.
You're making a case against yourself.
SNS is a great story too, because it also leveraged a couple other investments we've made previously. Fleet Pride, which is a Class 8 independent aftermarket truck parts business that we owned in the kind of 2006 to 2011 period, was a very successful investment for us. Plays in the same broad space as SNS, number one. Number two, one of our other investments, Arrowhead Engineered Products, which we invested in 2016. And exited in 2021, has a very similar business model from the standpoint of high quality new product introduction, where we're providing a private label product that has comparable, we would argue better, but comparable quality to an OE product, you know, at a much lower price point. And SNS was doing that same business model and really just getting going on it for their end market on the truck parts side. So we leveraged our experience in both Fleet Pride and Arrowhead to understand both the direct market, but also the new product and private label component of the business, and really positioned us. This was a proprietary deal with second generation family owners, who I think the combination of our expertise and what we've done, combined with, and I can come back to this, And I think developing a really good relationship with those second generation founders to pick us as their partner. And again, first time outside capital, like in Fortune. And also similarly to my comment in Shear, in the case of SNS, Steve Miller led that deal. And we have both our former CEO of Fleet Pride and our former CEO of Arrowhead on that board. And it's in addition to, you know, what we've learned as a team and what we've done and what our post-acquisition team does to have those additional resources to help accelerate the growth. And it's not just the growth, it's also how do you scale a business? If the business is at 100, then anytime we invest, we have to have conviction we can at least double the business in our hold period. And that means you're going to have to do things differently. You may need to add people to the team. You may need to think about org structure that will accommodate that growth, et cetera. And having people around the table, both the investment team and post-act team, but also some really capable and experienced independent directors is invaluable.
I do want to come back to that bit that you said about building relationships with second generation. What does that look like? You know, are you starting well before the investment? How are you building that relationship and that trust?
Yeah, it's an everyday thing. And everybody on the team, it's part of all of our jobs. And at the end of the day, the way we think about it is there's always a lot of variables, but in the private markets, you can have a great investment thesis, but it's not worth anything if you can't actually deploy capital against it. And so you need to find an opportunity and you need to find a willing counterparty. And what we've learned, and this is partly why we're focused where we're focused, the discipline on sticking to our verticals, developing those shadow portfolios, et cetera. Again, when you slice through all those variables, it usually comes down to two things that will drive somebody's decision. Number one, who do I think can add the most to my business? So that gets to, well, we focus on six verticals. We think we're pretty knowledgeable within certain areas of professional services, distribution and supply chain, industrial services, tech-enabled services, et cetera. And you've got to be credible. You also have to acknowledge a founder who's been running his or her business for 30 years is going to know more about their business and the intimacies of their business than we ever will. But there's other things that we can bring. So number one is who adds the most value to my business? And number two, who do they like the most? And even if it's a proprietary deal, because again, if it's a founder, he or she can say, you know, I'm going to hold on for a few more years, or maybe I'll borrow some money and pay myself a dividend. I don't need to sell some of my company to an outside partner. But if they feel good about the partnership, the human element of it, and that we're aligned on what are we trying to achieve, which goes back to we want to grow the business. We want the business to be sustainable and viable and successful long-term, well beyond our typical five-year investment period. And we take great pride in that. And we want to do it in a responsible way in terms of not deploying too much debt in the business and creating value for all the constituents or shareholders, but also employees. And we have a couple of our companies that we're invested in where there's 100% employee participation in the ownership, but also customers, suppliers, communities that we operate in. And we personally, our team takes real pride in being associated with a business that we invested when it was a $500 million business and it's now a $5 billion business. But it's also, those are great stories and great proof points of we can be a really meaningful part of that journey of long-term value creation.
And the employee ownership bit that you mentioned, at select companies that does exist, is that something that you, after you come in as an investor, offer that to the employees after discussing it with the CEO, founder, or is that already in place and you continue to support that?
Yeah, typically the latter. And it's not in every company, to be clear, but increasingly, and again, I would bifurcate a little bit on the more professional services business, think consulting firms, advisory firms. They tend to have started as partnerships. Maybe it's one or two partners or founders, but the equity ownership in those businesses tends to be much deeper than it does in more of an industrial type services business. But in the industrial services and supply chain businesses, we are starting to do deeper equity participation. And in one of our industrial services business, we do have 100% employee participation. And again, we're big believers in it from a number of dimensions, but one is we think it will help create that long-term, more sustainable value for the company. And two, you know, the more participation you have, obviously, I think it enhances the overall employee experience. And what we've learned is employees, there's no one variable that drives things. You know, there's a bit of a, I think it's a cliche, but I think it's borne out by some studies that people generally quit their bosses. It's not over the incremental dollar of comp. Comp's important. It's a whole package, though. Are we clear on what the vision, mission, values are of the business? Is that person's role clear? Do they have development? Some of the things we talked about earlier, the value of a senior level chief human resources officer who can help make sure a company has these plans and processes and practices in place to provide that development is super important. And having the equity component is just another way to both create and enhance somebody's commitment and loyalty to the firm.
100%. I agree with that. And about SNS truck parts, how long has that been in the portfolio, and has the business also done add-on acquisitions yet, or is it kind of evaluating that right now?
Yep. It's been in the portfolio for about 18 months. And yes, we had an opportunity, as I mentioned, that was a proprietary opportunity for us. And while we were working on finalizing our diligence and completing the deal, we had the opportunity to start talking to one of their competitors, also local, also still owned by the founding family. And it was exactly what I said, you know, an owner who was working through what his decision was in terms of next steps and monetization. And so we ultimately were able to add his business into the SNS fold shortly after we closed our deal. So not planned, and we weren't counting on that, but it was a transformational opportunity that came right as we were doing our work. And again, we leveraged the fact that we had that existing relationship. We were well down the path to do SNS. We also wound up having some touch points with that owner of the business, which I think gave him more comfort to just talk with us on an exclusive basis. So short answer is yes.
And is your typical investment timeframe, you mentioned 5 years earlier, is that usually like 3 to 5 years, or would you say more towards 5 years is how long you hold on to businesses?
Yes, we underwrite for 5 years. That's what we assume we'll hold. I think our actual holding period is within a half a year of that. So it's pretty close to that. And sometimes you wind up exiting early, and sometimes you wind up holding for longer, but in general, 5 years.
And I wanted to circle back to residential and facility services and talk about it more broadly outside of just HVAC. The sector has been a really hot investment target. Don't think M&A is as frenzied as it was in 2021 and early 22, but there are still a lot of deals happening there. I'm just curious to know from your perch what you're seeing in terms of buyer and seller interest this year in 2023.
Yes, your comments are right. And I think we've seen a little bit of bifurcation where volume is down, as you know, and largely driven by the increase in cost of capital. And depending on the end market, there has been more choppiness. And there's been so much impact that you have to try and normalize or understand the COVID impact, obviously starting in Q1 of 20, but it still continues to this day, depending on the sector to some degree. So you've seen a decrease in volume. The bifurcation is we're seeing a number of deals that just don't happen. And I think that's just a gap between what the seller thinks and what the buyer's prepared to do. And that may be a little bit of anchoring in where things were 18 months ago. And maybe a company hasn't had as good a performance, et cetera. And then on the other side, to your point, within certain sectors and certain companies, the valuation, if anything, has increased, which I know sounds very counterintuitive relative to the increase in interest rates and cost of capital over the past 18 months now, but it's true. We've seen some businesses that are in our sectors that have traded at multiples of EBITDA that are higher than they were if you go back to early 22.
And why is that? Is it because they're the best businesses out there right now?
I think, yeah, it's supply-demand dynamics from the standpoint of less supply. There's still a lot of capital to be put to work. And I think if somebody sees an opportunity where they think they can still earn an adequate return, they'll push harder. I think it will normalize. There is, as you said, there's a lot of backlog of businesses looking to come to market. There's also been a shift this year. And when you look at the proportion of companies that have come to market, it does tend to be more family or privately held, not institutional capital backed. I think you've seen the institutionally capital backed businesses hold off. They want more certainty, et cetera. And others may be more willing to pursue something. So our hope and expectation is things normalize a little bit once the calendar flips and once you get past year end. And hopefully there will be, at least as it relates to the interest rate and cost of capital side, more clarity around, you know, is the Fed actually done and are we stabilizing?
And obviously cost of capital bring me to the one subject everyone is talking about, private credit. It's obviously booming right now and there's just endless stories on it. But private credit has always been a crucial part of middle market M&A for a really long time. So I'm just curious to know if this sudden boom has shifted anything from your perspective as an investor when you were looking at sort of financing from direct lenders.
No, your comments are right, but it hasn't really changed what we do and how we do it and who we do it with. We have a little bit like when we talk about getting to know a company and a CEO and the executive team. Same on the financing side. We have a core group of firms, both banks and private credit firms, direct lenders that we've developed long-term relationships that we work with on multiple deals. And that's also stabilized. Again, the rates are higher for sure. But I also think because we maximize the leverage, we have to accommodate the increased cost. Although I will also say, this is a little bit of a detail, but we always, when we make an investment, we underwrite the forward curve. So we actually looked at it and said, well, geez, rates have gone up 500 basis points in the past, you know, year and a half plus, year and three quarters. What has that done to our projected returns, all else equal? And it's less than a 1% impact. And the reason is because when we did the original underwriting, you know, LIBOR at that time or SOFR may have been zero, but it was a floor of 100 bips or 125 bips. But the forward curve had already contemplated an increase in interest rates. So it's definitely having an impact, don't get me wrong, but from our perspective, it's manageable. And the lenders that we partner with have continued to be supportive, continue to be in business. As you mentioned, Shear Supply is our last investment that we made in April. Some of our existing partners lent into that deal, very good terms, very good package. So we feel good about that.
That's a really interesting bit about the good terms and financing being stable. Because the one thing that I've heard about private credit in general is that even they have kind of taken a bit of a cautionary stance this year where they're not as willing to finance things as they were last year. They've kind of reduced their hold sizes and things like that. I'm curious to know, broadly speaking, if that's something you've seen as well.
Yeah, I think it's very, again, general statement. I think that's been for sure more true in the big cap market and the syndicated loan market where banks are trying to minimize how much the big banks have to keep on their balance sheet. They've certainly gotten more risk off than risk on. I also think it's within sectors. There's going to be certain sectors that it will be very hard to get a lender excited about lending into, and they would be sectors that you would know. And again, in our world in general, yes, you know, the cost has gone up and there's been a little bit more caution, but we haven't seen it hasn't materially impacted. When we look at a business, it hasn't materially impacted our thoughts about the business or our interest in the business.
And with that, I'm curious to know what your pipeline looks like, if there are any specific categories within the sectors you invest in that you're more likely to make investments in. Again, I know, tough question, putting you on the spot, but I would love to know just a little bit of a forward-looking commentary on what's next for the firm or your division in particular.
If you think, if I look across our six verticals, our tech-enabled services, professional and knowledge and professional, knowledge being education, but professional services, data and information, kind of the white-collar businesses. And then on the other side, industrial services, supply chain and distribution, and specialty consumer, which is really kind of an adjacency to the industrial services. It tends to be industrial, more B2C, like a wrench where an HVAC dealer is selling to a consumer. But across those verticals, we have a couple of pretty interesting opportunities at various stages in each of industrial services and tech-enabled services. And then maybe a little bit further out, you know, we've got a couple in professional services, like the RoadSafe example that I mentioned. It, you know, we worked for multiple years. We have a couple in professional services we've been working for multiple years. By the way, they may never happen. It's the nature of the beast. And then similarly, in supply chain and distribution, that's over time probably been our most active vertical. And we have pretty clear things that we look for from an industry structure standpoint, from a supplier standpoint, customer standpoint, the value add of the business, et cetera. So those three or four verticals, I would say, are most active with a pipeline that's most robust.
What have I not asked you so far about InvestCorp or the M&A landscape right now that you think would be interesting to discuss? I know we didn't touch upon Elixir or ICR, which are also very interesting investments if you want to talk about that. But yeah, I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
I would just repeat, I mean, for us, we really do think we have a great opportunity just given the space we play in, the size we play in. We think of as our value prop to a family or founder-led business who wants to continue to be involved, continue to be a large investor, continue to grow and scale the business. And I would say more broadly across InvestCorp, because we do invest globally, we do PE in the developed markets of the US and Europe, but also building out those capabilities. We've been investing in the MENA region for 15 years, but also building out those capabilities in Asia. We have a great team in India. And a lot of the same, even though the deals may be different because those markets are in different stages of evolution, some of the same tenets in terms of we're looking for growth, we're often partnering with founders, we want to be value-add partners.
Well, thank you so much for a great conversation, Dave. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. Great talking to you.
This is Nikita Satyaraju, senior reporter at The Deal. Thanks for tuning in to Behind the Buyouts.